You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 113. And with me tonight is Kelly Taylor, Yeah, how you doing, Kelly?
Go ahead, Rod. Sorry.
It's okay. We have this lag sometimes, and every once in a while we stomp on each other. So if that happens, we'll get over it. Now go ahead and introduce yourself, Kelly.
My name is Kelly Taylor. I am a consultant in the nuclear industry part-time. The rest of the time I am a stay-at-home mom, although I'm not very good at staying at home, but I spend a lot of time at home. I have 21 years nuclear experience before becoming a consultant. I have worked for utilities. I have worked at a nuclear power station. I've worked in the corporate offices. Some of my experience was in an engineering department. Some of it was in operations department. So I kept skipping around until they got tired of me. Or until I got tired of them. So, experience in all kinds of different areas, and the rest of it, I spend my free time studying. So, I'm just really a nuclear nerd.
And I love nuclear geeks. Like Kelly, I'm one who cannot hold a job. I've had quite a number of different tasks and assignments within the Navy, and even took a little bit of time off the Navy and spent 6 years trying to run a business and then successfully running another business before I decided to re-enter the Navy and do some staff work. So anyway, we've been having some interesting exchanges of email. Kelly is a lifelong resident of Virginia, I believe. Is that correct, Kelly?
No, but I've been in Virginia since I was in high school, so it's almost correct.
Okay. And one of the things that's happened in the nuclear industry that's been pretty exciting in the last few weeks is that a longtime stalwart of the Virginia nuclear or the Virginia industry, Northrop Grumman Shipbuilding, has agreed with Areva to build a component manufacturing facility near the Northrop Grumman Newport News shipyard. And I find that to be a fascinating development, particularly since there's a little corridor of Virginia that appears to be maybe the uranium alley of the U.S.
Oh, you mean because of the ships they're already manufacturing?
Well, because if you draw a line from Lynchburg, which hosts Babcock and Wilcox and Areva, and you include a place in Southern Virginia called Coles Hill, where there's a deposit of about $10 billion worth of uranium, and you take that line and you continue on, include Dominion Resources Surrey plant, and then the nuclear ships that are in the Norfolk area, which includes obviously the ability to maintain them, the ability to build them at Northrop Grumman Newport News. You got quite a little infrastructure of people who understand nuclear power, who have all kinds of skills on various parts of the nuclear fuel cycle. And just, like I said, kind of the beginnings of a uranium alley there.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, but you have to put an asterisk next to the uranium deposit since there's a moratorium on uranium mining in Virginia.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not legal to mine any of that uranium. It just happens to be there.
Yes, but it is now approved to study whether or not the uranium could be mined safely, and that by itself is a recent coup. I think the legislature just passed unanimously a bill allowing the folks that own the uranium to study, find out whether or not the uranium can be mined safely. And I guess they're going to include some folks from Virginia Tech as third-party independent observers. Of course, the particular organization of Virginia Tech didn't seem completely independent to me, but since it includes the name Cole in the middle of their name.
I had two different people send me the Forbes article that you shared with me, and definitely the best quote from that article came from Delegate Terry Kilgore, who said, "We need to leave no stone unturned on this. If it's not safe, we don't want to do it."
Yes, now that of course, is the law of the land in Virginia, which I believe hosts about 134 coal mines.
Yeah, leave no stone unturned.
Yeah, I think they've been turning over stones in the mining industry in Virginia for a very long time, and not always for fuels that are perfectly safe.
Well, yeah, that's true. There is no fuel that's perfectly safe.
You don't have any argument from me. I mean, when you want energy, that means that you're going to find fuels that have the potential to release power quickly. That always has the potential for danger. And, of course, anytime you're digging underground, you have the potential to change some things, release some things that have been locked up in under the Earth's surface for a long period of time. And you have to do it carefully. I don't have any qualms about, you know, carefully studying whether or not the uranium can be mined safely and in ways it keeps the tailings and whatnot out of the water supplies. But one of the things that always appealed to me when I learned about Coles Hill was that the family that owns the deposit plans to continue living on their family estate while the mining is going on.
Yeah, and that's exactly the reason why they have held on to the lands for as long as they have and have been instrumental in the business transaction that's trying to get the Virginia legislature to talk about the possibility of mining and to open, basically to lift the moratorium as a long-term goal. In the short term, they had to do a study to say, is it safe under current technology to do uranium mining without destroying the environment, without harming the workers, and so on and so forth, because the state of Virginia is not interested in opening up a new type of mining operation that will not be good for their communities, that will not be good for the people that live and work here. And there is a lot of controversy about uranium mining in general, and I haven't studied enough of the details about it to know how much of it is still valid concerns and how much of it is not. Now, a lot of the history from uranium mining is unfortunate history, because not all the uranium that was mined for peaceful purposes, and because of the goals and that they had in mind while they were extracting it from the ground, they weren't really too concerned about individual communities that were nearby because they had larger national security issues that they were dealing with at the time. So I know there have been some really sad stories that go along with uranium mining, but I don't know that that is still necessarily true for today's mining technology and today's mining goals and purposes. So I look forward to see what the results of the study will bring out. And I also applaud this family for being instrumental in what they consider something key to Virginia's energy future rather than just selling what they had and taking the money and run.
I agree with you. And there isn't a long history. Well, not a long history. Obviously, the uranium mining history is actually fairly short. We didn't even try to start mining uranium in the U.S. until about the mid-1950s. Before, in the 1940s, during the war, we actually got most of our uranium from sources outside the U.S., and we're doing a little bit of research here in the U.S. But you're right. When we had a drive to build up an arsenal of nuclear weapons during the 1950s, there wasn't a lot of care. But then again, there wasn't a lot of care in a lot of mining activities. And one of the problems that we had was underground mines, where there is a concentration of uranium, had high levels of radon, and the miners like many people in the 1950s, tended to be smokers as well as being exposed to large doses of radon. And the combination of that appears to be far more dangerous than either smoking or radon by itself. So there were a lot of lung diseases in the mines that were not properly ventilated. But we've learned a lot from that time. And I think ever since about 1970, the mining regulations and the conditions in uranium mines have been much healthier than people make them out to be.
Well, I look forward to learning that. I don't understand the people that were opposed to doing a study of what the status of the technology is. When is learning more information ever a bad idea? I couldn't understand why there was so much vocal opposition to that. You know, we're just doing a study to find out what can be done or what should not be done with the mining possibilities.
Well, there are people who make a profession out of opposing nearly everything. Now, there are many folks that interpret that as a desire to halt technology and go back to some sort of pastoral, idealized version of the world. But I continue to believe that most Luddites have reasons for slowing development of competition. And in Virginia, the coal mining industry is quite well established and has had a long history of prosperity. And they understand that uranium is a competitor to coal.
Yeah, it is. You know, if given a choice between living next door to a nuclear power station or a coal-powered station, there's not too many people that would choose coal over uranium or over nuclear. But I suppose there are some, and they're welcome to it. I'm not among them.
Yes, well, of course, as a country, we seem to be far more accepting of burning coal than burning uranium, at least so far. You know, coal provides 50% of electricity, and uranium only provides 20%.
Do you want to talk about the new administration in line with that?
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the interesting discussions during the campaign was the difference in energy policy between the President-elect Obama and the contender, John McCain, who was a very large, outspoken proponent of nuclear development.
It's kind of interesting. Obama comes from Illinois, and I'm sorry I didn't look up the figures before this meeting, but Illinois has a lot of nuclear power stations in it. So I don't have any misconceptions that Obama fails to recognize the benefit of commercial nuclear power. He comes from a state that gets a lot of their power from nuclear.
50%.
I heard one friend of mine offer up an opinion that when the campaign was early, when the presidential campaign was early, McCain's attitude of all of the above, basically we need all the energy resources we can get from wherever we can get them because inexpensive energy and a diverse power supply is good for the country as a whole. It's good for national security issues. It's good for business. It's good for manufacturing. It's just good. You know, inexpensive energy benefits everybody. It benefits anybody that pays an electric bill, which is all of us. And when Obama couldn't make any headway with his picking and choosing, well, there's problems with this and problems with the other, if you look at, you know, different pockets within his party, you can find somebody that opposes just about every energy supply that's out there. And my friend said, you know, once Obama recognized that McCain was making headway with his all-of-the-above strategy, Obama changed his tactics to become more like him. I did get to go to a teleconference with North American Young Generation in Nuclear that was they were interviewing an Obama supporter who was talking about Obama's energy policy. So it wasn't with Barack Obama himself, but it was with someone representing his campaign. Now, I also have to put an asterisk on this and say at the time it was scheduled, they had plans and every expectation that they would do a similar conference with John McCain and his party and his supporters, but unfortunately, due to schedule and time and campaign limitations, that they were never able to put that together. So it's not like they were doing favoritism with one candidate or the other. And in that teleconference, this man from Obama's camp, if you will, was saying that
I think that was Jason Grummet, who was one of Obama's main energy policy advisors.
Thank you, because I'm not good with names. I was hoping you'd be able to fill that in for me. He said that, yeah, Obama was not necessarily opposed to nuclear, although he did want to know that we could handle it safely and cleanly. The biggest concern that Obama had was over the nuclear waste, of course, which we have handled safely and cleanly through the entire history of, you know, of taking the waste out of the reactors and storing it. We haven't had any issues with the on-site storage. We look forward to having a central repository in Yucca Mountain or somewhere else, however that ends up turning out. But he did come right out and say that Obama was not opposed to commercial nuclear power and that new technologies were something that this incoming administration was willing and eager to look at.
Yeah, I have listened carefully to what Obama has said about all energy sources, and I'm pretty encouraged because one of the things that he does say, which tends to upset a lot of folks in the established energy industry, is that he believes that there needs to be a charge for emitting noxious gases, including CO2. And I believe that the free use of the atmosphere as a dumping ground has been something that has been a disadvantage to the nuclear industry because we do store and retain all of our waste on site. There is some cost associated with that. It's not free for us.
Right.
Whereas the competition, the coal, gas, and oil industries, have been able to simply build a stack and dump their waste into the environment. Now, granted, they have some controls in some plants, at least those aren't grandfathered in by being constructed pre-1973 or something. But, you know, that has been a competitive disadvantage. I believe that in any competition, a utility that looks at the choice between building a nuclear plant and building a coal plant that has to pay for its emissions or has to retain its emissions, there's no doubt in my mind which one will win the economic competition because it's simply easier to retain a little bit of material, even if it's potentially dangerous, than it is to retain a vast quantity of gas. It's simply an easier process.
Right.
And I found a very interesting comment from Steve Forbes in a recent editorial in Forbes magazine. He's the title of it's called "The Miraculous March to the White House," and Steve Forbes, who's not known as being a liberal, and of course a lot of folks that want to tag President-elect Obama with that tag, has this to say about Obama's nuclear policy. Quote: "Even more amazing will be his support of new nuclear power plant construction. Obama will let congressional Democrats and Republicans take the legislative lead, but he will make it quietly clear that he'll sign virtually any pro-nuclear legislation that they can pass, while publicly pretending to be mighty reluctant to do so."
I haven't heard it said that well. But behind the scenes, I have heard comments very similar to that. He comes from a nuclear state. He understands nuclear power. He is not going to get in the way of it.
Yep. And he did, was one of the pro votes, the in-favor votes of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which many people in the nuclear industry have pointed to as what has shifted the conversation from maybe we'll build a couple of plants under the New START partnership to try to test the licensing process to, what are there, about 21 applications already filed now with another 10 or 15 left to be filed?
Yeah, and but I also think back to, did you say that the NAYGN man on that conference was Jason Grummet?
Grummet, yes.
When I listened carefully to his comments, what I heard was a politician's answer. He came down on both sides of the aisle. Regardless of how you felt about nuclear, you had something to embrace in what he had to say.
Well, they are politicians, so I
not
guess
not a lot.
I guess that's not terribly surprising.
I didn't really learn a lot from it. I didn't come away feeling like I had learned more than I knew before the conference. So.
Yeah. Well, one of the things historically that the nuclear industry has had happen was there was a time when there was a joint congressional committee on atomic energy that was amazingly supportive of new nuclear power developments, was spending a lot of money and producing a lot of policies in favor of nuclear and establishing even government-owned programs and proposing to build government-owned reactors all over the place. And that real strong support for a competitor to large established industries caused some real challenges politically. And the coal industry got very, very upset about the idea that the government was using their tax dollars to build up a competitor. So the coal industry was one of the big legislative supporters of getting rid of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, which was also at the same time that they broke up the Atomic Energy Commission and shifted it from being an integrated agency, sort of like the Federal Aviation Administration, to being one where there was a regulator whose only legislative directive was to regulate, and then a separate organization who retained the promotional aspects. And that particular part, the promotional aspects, got really convoluted because it initially went into the Energy Research and Development Agency, which then got rolled into the Department of Energy, which really has a main goal of building and controlling our weapons stockpile. So that shift from the Atomic Energy Commission to the separate groups has been one of the things that has, I think, slowed the development, but perhaps for logical reasons.
I'm thinking overall that's not a bad thing. You can't have the same agency trying to regulate the industry that they're charged with promoting.
Well, except, like I said, the FAA does that. So do a number, the Interstate Trucking, Interstate Commerce Committee, or Interstate Commerce Administration, the one that regulates trucking, does that. They both promote and regulate. One of the things that's always bothered me about the legislative directive given to the NRC is that they view nuclear risks in isolation. In other words, they don't pay attention to the security risk or the risk associated with the replacement power for any time that they take their legislative or their regulatory actions. You know, they would shut down a nuclear plant that has a certain level of risk, not recognizing that the replacement power may include 10 to 100 times more risk because they're not directed to pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's kind of one thing that makes me nervous about the whole change mantra. Okay, let's just change everything. Well, changing everything, you know, if you're working, and I'm not saying that we are, but in theory, if you were working within a scientific environment and you wanted better results with whatever you were working on, you would change things one at a time to see what works better and what improves it, find out what the results are, and then change the next thing. When you change everything at once, you have no controls over where you're headed and no intelligence for which changes were beneficial, which ones were detrimental, and which ones, you know, to undo. Well, just, you know, you could end up with the same mess and a whole bunch of different causes and not recognize how you got there or why. But we know the coal industry can't be too happy with Obama's remarks about them, since he's been reported for saying that anybody that wanted to build a coal plant would go bankrupt trying to operate it.
You know, I actually have the full quote that he had. I wish I could figure out a way to play it to you, because it's about a minute and a half long. I may add it to the show.
I knew when I saw the news clips that the quote had to be taken out of context, and I suspected that they had done an injustice to what he was trying to say.
Well, the interesting part of the clip was that the start of the discussion was a question from a reporter questioning how he could possibly be in favor of coal-to-liquids technology. In other words, she was asking why he was supporting the coal industry by his stance on coal-to-liquids technology.
Okay. So
he tried to explain that, and like I said, I've got the full quote, and it's a fairly complicated thing, but in essence what he said about coal plants was that he expected that they would have to take account of their emissions, hopefully storing them in a carbon sequestration, which will go beyond. The man's a lawyer, not a scientist, so I can forgive him for not understanding that carbon sequestration is a non-starter. But anyway, he said basically, if someone was to build a coal plant and not account for the emissions, they may very well go bankrupt, because we're not going to let them get away with, you know, giving it, you know, emitting it freely.
Now, see, that's what I suspected he meant all along. When I heard all the misquotes and everything else that the news media did with it, they painted him as being opposed to clean coal, which doesn't begin to make sense. And I'm like, there's no way he could have said that. He must have been opposed to conventional coal power stations and in favor of clean coal that would not have the CO2 emissions. And I saw a couple news agencies that came along that way, but when they translated it just in the headlines, if you're only looking for sound bites, then they made it sound like anybody that wanted to build a clean coal plant would go bankrupt. No, it's anybody that wanted to build a coal plant that didn't account for the CO2 emissions, you would end up going bankrupt paying for how much carbon dioxide you're pouring into the air.
Right.
I suspect that was where he was going with it all along, and then the media just had a field day with it.
Right, and he was talking about new coal plants, not necessarily
about shutting down what we already have or anything else.
Right, and not necessarily saying that an existing coal plant would go bankrupt if it started to have to pay for its emissions, because some of the operating coal plants on the grid are the cheapest power sources in their area. They could very easily have to pay for their emissions and still be competitive against the other alternatives in their area. But if
right.
you try to build a new coal-fired power plant from scratch, and when you're doing your economic analysis, you don't pay attention to the fact that you may very well be charged for emissions, you would probably come up with a spreadsheet, a project income sheet, that would not be competitive down the road, because a coal-fired power plant is going to be expensive to build to begin with. You know, there's probably more steel, concrete, and equipment associated with coal than with nuclear.
Yeah, or maybe about the same, but certainly any really large baseload plant is going to have comparable costs. They're very expensive to put in initially.
Right. Well, people forget about some of the things that you have to do to build a coal plant. For example, they forget about the fact that you may have to build a train line to the plant. And you may have to buy 100 or 200 train cars to carry your coal, depending on where your coal is coming from. You probably have to build a reception facility for the coal. You have to build a crusher. You have to build conveyor belts.
Anywhere that it could freeze and you can't get it, you know, chipped off the block in order to send it to the boilers.
Right. You have to build.
And all the conveyor belts have to be heated for however long you transport from the coal pile to the boilers.
Mm-hmm. You betcha. And you have to put in scrubbers. You have to put in bag houses. You have to put in places to store the fly ash. I mean, it's a very large and capital-intensive project to build even a cleaner coal-fired power plant than what we have available today.
At this point, I want to take a little detour. Kelly and I have been working from memory, but I want you to hear, in his own words, the interview that caused the tempest in a teapot about President-elect Obama's thoughts about the coal-fired power industry. This excerpt is from an interview conducted with the San Francisco Chronicle on January 17, 2008, and is the source of the comments that said that Obama wants to bankrupt the coal-fired power industry.
Kai Melner, one of the editorial writers. So, Senator, you introduced a bill promoting coal-to-liquid fuels, and then you said you'd only support them if they emitted fewer greenhouse gases than gasoline. Now, all the scientific evidence points to coal being dirtier than pretty much anything else. So how are you going to square your support for coal with the need to fight global warming?
Well, I've already done it. I voted against the Clear Skies Bill. In fact, I was the deciding vote, despite the fact that I'm a coal state and that half of my state thought I'd thoroughly betrayed them because I think clean air is critical and global warming is critical. But this notion of no coal, I think, is an illusion, because the fact of the matter is that right now we are getting a lot of our energy from coal, and China is building a coal-powered plant once a week. So what we have to do then is we have to figure out how can we use coal without emitting greenhouse gases and carbon. And, you know, how can we sequester that carbon and capture it? If we can't, then, you know, we're going to still be working on alternatives. But
alternatives including coal or alternatives?
Let me sort of describe my overall policy. I mean, what I've said is that we would put a cap and trade system in place that is more that is as aggressive, if not more aggressive, than anybody else's out there. I was the first to call for 100% auction on the cap and trade system, which means that every unit of carbon or greenhouse gas that was emitted would be charged to the polluter. That will create a market in which whatever technologies are out there that are being presented, whatever power plants that are being built, that they would have to meet the rigors of that market and the ratcheted down caps that are placed, imposed every year. So if somebody wants to build a coal-powered plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they're going to be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas that's being emitted. That will also generate billions of dollars that we can invest in solar, wind, biodiesel, and other alternative energy approaches. The only thing that I've said with respect to coal, I haven't been some coal booster. What I have said is that for us to take coal off the table as a ideological matter, as opposed to saying if technology allows us to use coal in a clean way, we should pursue it. That I think is the right approach. The same is with respect to nuclear. Right now, we don't know how to store nuclear waste wisely, and we don't know how to deal with some of the safety issues that remain. And so it's wildly expensive to pursue nuclear energy. But I tell you what, if we could figure out how to store it safely, then I think most of us would say that might be a pretty good deal. The point is, if we set rigorous standards for the allowable emissions, then we can allow the market to determine and technology and entrepreneurs to pursue what's the best approach to take, as opposed to us saying at the outset, here are the winners that we're picking, And maybe we pick wrong and maybe we pick right.
Think for yourself. Does it sound to you like he wants to bankrupt the industry? Now back to the rest of my conversation with Kelly.
There's a reason. I mean, a lot of folks have repeated many times that, well, we haven't built a new nuclear plant in 30 years. If I'm not mistaken, the last time we built a new baseload coal plant was about 25 years ago.
Well, yeah, because once we had an overabundance of baseload, we had an overabundance of all baseload. So, you know, we weren't building nuclear, we weren't building coal, we had plenty of lots of baseload. We're not there anymore. We've grown enough, our economy has grown enough, that we're ready for more baseload plants to go in, and unfortunately the economy's in a rough spot to be putting them in right now. But we don't have any choice. We can't do without them.
Well, we do have a choice. We could always just stop using electricity. Or, I shouldn't say that. We do have a choice, and actually the economy doing what it's doing has pushed out the time when we really need new baseload, because there are empty houses that are no longer consuming electricity. There are businesses that used to run and are now shut down, so they're not consuming electricity. You know, there's all kinds of things that are causing us to be able to use less electricity. Now, it's not some sort of technological solution that made us more energy efficient. It's simply doing less with less.
Yes and no. We really do need more baseload now. And the fact remains, you can't put in a baseload power station generally in a year, 18 months. We're talking about big power stations that may take 3 or 4 years to build. You know, everybody talked about the Kyoto protocols and most of Europe adopted them and said, yeah, we'll go along with them. The nation that met them without any problems was Russia, because they had a recession hit right after their Kyoto protocol. So they met all their greenhouse gas emission requirements because their economy shrank. I'm not recommending doing that. It's got way other, you know, more far reaching ramifications than simply saying, oh yeah, we have less CO2 emissions because we're using less electricity because we're not producing anything. So we're not producing near as much. But yeah, that works. And shrink the economy, and your power needs will go down dramatically.
Yeah, and it's worked for California. Now, of course, their overall economy actually grew a bit, but their manufacturing economy, their energy-intensive part of their economy, has dramatically shrunk over the past 30 years. So they are more, quote, energy-efficient per unit of GNP, but it's because they have shifted their economy. And actually, the reality is, if you were to count the emissions from all of the products that they buy from other places, they probably aren't any more efficient than they used to be. They just move the energy consumption to someplace else.
Right, and then put in power lines to bring it into the state.
Well, either power lines or, like I said, if you buy a finished product, that product has an energy content in it. If you do the accounting correctly, an automobile coming into the state on the back of a truck actually brings with it an implied amount of energy consumed to produce that automobile.
Yeah, that's true.
I used to be a cost accountant, so I had to understand how to build the spreadsheets, include everything that goes into a product. It was fun. I get excited by weird stuff.
That was fun. You were very well placed while you were being a cost accountant. I don't feel sorry for you at all.
Green eye shades are my thing. All right. So, let's see. We had some other things we want to talk about today, and I forget what the heck they were.
Well, that's okay. I have one that we didn't mention ahead of time.
Okay. Go ahead.
Did you pay any attention, or do you have any useful information to add on the sale of Constellation?
I paid a fair amount of attention to it. The sale of Constellation to Warren Buffett.
He
got a great deal.
Oh, yeah, he did. That's what happens when you have cash handy when somebody needs it.
Yeah.
He picked up an entire utility to the tune of $5 billion. That's like the cost of one baseload power station. You got a whole utility for that price. That is just an awesome deal.
Yeah, particularly since that utility has, what, about 12,000 megawatts of baseload power generation between the coal and its nuclear plants?
What I was trying to figure out is what does that mean for that utility and for the rest of the industry in general? Now, just I don't know enough about his purchasing practices to know, is this a major impact on essentially the corporate politics and policies where the utility will go from here on out? I know that Electricité de France tried to block the sale because they wanted to purchase Constellation and eventually backed out of it. So the sale's going to go forward. The merger will go forward with MidAmerican. But this basically means what was a publicly traded utility will go private. It's a cash deal. They're not trading any stocks to the current stockholders. They will pay them in cash.
Well, here's what I think. And I have studied Warren Buffett quite a bit over the years. He is a very well-studied investor. And one of the things that Warren Buffett seems to do is he buys companies where he likes the management and likes what they're doing already. He doesn't always buy the whole company, but he buys into those companies.
Right.
For example, he's been a long-time investor in Coca-Cola, in The Washington Post, in See's Candies, Geico Insurance.
If you study the different schools of investment thought, Warren Buffett is definitely a values investor, not the buy low, sell high kind of day trader sort of investor.
No, he is a guy who studies balance sheets. He studies the management. He looks at what the business is. One of his philosophies is he does not buy businesses he does not understand. So he understands, he's been studying electricity. He also likes businesses that are monopolies or near monopolies, like utilities. Utilities fit right in with what Buffett likes to do. I believe that, you know, a lot of folks have wondered what it means to Constellation's participation in the Unistar partnership with Areva and EDF. And I think it's beneficial because I believe that Buffett has learned a lot about nuclear power. MidAmerican studied a particular plant in Idaho, dropped the project, but I think they learned a lot about the economics of nuclear. And just because it didn't work in Idaho, which has the lowest electricity costs in the entire country, does not mean it won't work around the country where there's markets where people pay two or three times as much as they do in Idaho. Now, the cost of electricity in the marketplace is very important for the economics of a new plant. It doesn't make sense to build a plant in a low-cost market. It makes a lot more sense to build a plant where you can sell the stuff for high.
Exactly. The cost of the product you're producing goes right to your bottom line. How are you going to get a return on your investment if the other thing that happens is you bring a particularly if it's a large power plant online in a market that has low prices already, you're basically lowering the prices. You know, you're working, it's almost anti-competitive. You're working against yourself. You're lowering the prices because you're delivering a lot more of the product to from the seller's point of view to a suppressed market already. So you're undercutting people that you know, aren't making a lot of money to begin with. Which
Absolutely. Yeah, very good analysis. And, of course, electricity is a product that has to be generated when used and pretty much generated close to where it's used. It can't be shipped too far.
Which also, since we're talking about Unistar, have we talked about the Northrop Grumman thing? Unistar will definitely get a benefit from the new facility they're talking about putting into the shipyards.
I'm not sure if we've talked about it because we were talking before I started recording, and I can't remember what we said before I started recording and after. But
well, I'm right there with you.
Okay. So in case we haven't talked about it, and if we did, this a repeat, but last week, I believe, Northrop Grumman and Arriva announced the signing of a deal to build a $350+ million facility in Newport News, Virginia, near the Newport News shipyard, that will build large components for new nuclear power plants.
Oh, we touched on a little bit while you were talking about the nuclear corridor in Virginia, but we didn't talk specifically about the Northrop Grumman facility. Now, the thing that they're going to put in is focused primarily on the EPR design, which is the next generation French reactor, which is why it's such a big benefit to Unistar, because that is the design that Unistar is marketing and what they're looking to build in the United States. But I'm thrilled just from a standpoint all around. New nuclear is new nuclear. And I like the new designs and the new mindset that goes into the safety first and using gravity where it benefits you and fewer components and things like that. So I don't have anything against the EPR design or any of the other new designs that are out there. I've always maintained that the large component production piece was one of the biggest bottlenecks for new nuclear build. So even if this facility is not, for example, building the ESBWR that Dominion has chosen for the North Anna site, I still think it's a benefit to all involved, because anybody putting in a new N-stamped, you know, certified facility anywhere in the country shows that it can be done, and if they can do it for this design, somebody else might be willing to do it for a different design. The other advantage that you get from having the steel production facility and the large component production facility here in the United States is it's less of a bottleneck, so there's more availability of the components, and it's less transportation costs, so there's less fuel used in the transportation, less greenhouse gas emissions. The stuff is closer to where it needs to be used, and I think everybody benefits that way. Plus, they're using American employees to build it with, and that doesn't hurt my feelings either.
Well, I'm a big fan of using American employees to build things, because I think one of the real failures in American big business over the last 20 years is a failure to recognize that if you continue to ship jobs overseas, yet you want to keep selling things into the American market where people are good buyers of things, you're basically killing yourself eventually.
Yep. You're undercutting your customers. You're financing customers in other places that don't have the same culture, that don't have the same purchase preferences. You're working against your own business model.
Right. I mean, one of the big successes of Henry Ford, actually James Cousins, but Henry Ford gets the credit, $5 a day wage policy, was that single act helped establish the market for automobiles in the U.S. Until workers started making a decent living, there wasn't a very big market for cars.
Right. If they couldn't afford their own product, then who were you going to sell it to?
Exactly. And that's the case of a lot of things that we have shifted the job overseas here in the U.S. And particularly, the thing that really is irritating is when you look at the economics of many of the products that are now being manufactured somewhere else, the labor content of those products is maybe 20% to 30% of the cost of the product. Okay, so you are saving a little bit on the total cost of the product, but you're also increasing the cost of transportation. Like you said, if you build something further and further away, you have to add more and more greenhouse gases to move it to where you're going to use it. And it's a silly way to run a country. And I think that business schools that kept telling people that you ought to look overseas to build stuff were just flat out wrong. I can't tell you how many times when I was trying to start up my little company, people told me, well, Rod, just take it overseas. You'll do better over there.
I don't know. I've heard so many surprises business owners run into by trying to take their business overseas. It looks like it'll be good, but if you're running slim margins on the balance sheet and you run into a surprise with, you know, putting out a quality product and have to recall 20% of what you've produced, that's a really expensive lesson.
Yes, it is. And, of course, the other risk of taking your production capacity overseas is somebody else now controls a very important part of your business. And they have access to everything they need to know to become a competitor.
Exactly.
And certain countries in this world really don't have much respect for intellectual property and have no compunction about learning how to make your product and then suddenly either selling it out the back door in the gray market or selling it directly out in the front door with a new label and calling it their own. Hey, it happens.
Yeah.
I think it's going to happen to Westinghouse myself. But
ouch.
I don't think that Westinghouse is going to sell more than 4 plants to China.
Oh, yeah, I don't think they'll get very far with that either. China has some really heavy clauses buried in their contract that they tried to put together with Arriva. And I don't have the latest information on how that went or if the Arriva went ahead with the contract or not, but I know that while China was negotiating with Arriva, the clauses that were included basically were, you will teach us how to do the entire fuel cycle from beginning to end, how to mine and how to enrich our own fuel. And that's part of the deal of us buying plants from you.
Yep. I fully believe that at some point in the future, if the Chinese AP1000s are successful, Westinghouse will find themselves competing against their own design in markets that they don't expect to compete against the Chinese in.
Well, they should be expecting to compete. Never mind.
Never mind. Okay. Anyway.
Fine.
So I'm very excited by, and of course the there was another article about the whole industrial support given to Newport News, given to Northrop Grumman by Newport News. Northrop Grumman Shipbuilding has been a big part of the Newport News economy for a long, long time, and the city was very supportive of their efforts with Arriva to expand. And, of course, there's some great synergies there. Newport News has a tremendous facility in terms of transportation. They've got railroads coming in. They've got a great highway system that sometimes has too much traffic.
Cranes on the grid are down there.
Say again?
The largest cranes on the grid are down there.
Yep. And they've got some good waterborne transportation, and so they'll be able to ship those heavy components just about anywhere from Newport News. Of course, Newport News also has spent a lot of time the last 50 years building nuclear power plants with large components. They just put those nuclear power plants onto ships called aircraft carriers, and they've been going to sea for a long time. So the employees at the Newport News and in Newport News understand nuclear power very well. And they understand the requirements and the material constraints and the quality inspection procedures and the paperwork and all the other things they're going to go into making sure that new end plant stamp keeps its end stamp.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's a wonderful fit for all involved. I'm excited for Northrop. I'm excited for Northrop Grumman. I'm excited for Arriva. I told you earlier, I had some friends at Arriva that were just busting a gut because they knew weeks before the announcement and weren't allowed to tell anybody. It's like, I cannot wait until the news breaks. So we don't have to keep it a secret anymore. They're going to put in a new large component construction facility down in the shipyards. Yay! It's good news for Virginia, and I think it's good news for the United States, too.
Yep. The only thing that they probably need to do, though, and I say this from personal experience, they do need to expand Interstate 64 because right around Newport News, it goes from four lanes down to two right before you get to Busch Gardens. If you're coming from north up going towards Richmond on 64, the traffic there on a Saturday morning is just incredible. My daughter lives in Virginia Beach, so we were down there during the summertime and decided to go to Busch Gardens for the day. It was a long wait on that neck down stretch of road. You ever been on that stretch of 64?
I have. Not very often, but I've had my turn sitting there in traffic.
Yeah. It's a very interesting, if you pay attention to the entrances and exits there, it's one of the few interstates I know of where there's gates that come down, that can come down at every entrance and exit. You ever notice that?
I think I have noticed it, but it's one of those things I didn't understand it and I didn't have anyone to ask, so I wasn't able to follow up on that. What is up with those?
There's a facility on that road at Yorktown that occasionally you need to be able to isolate the highway.
Well, that is just fascinating.
That's as much as I can say.
Well, that was probably too much right there. I was, you know, happy just to be curious and not have any information.
You still don't have any information.
Yeah, but now I know that I don't have any information. I liked it better when I didn't know there was information that I didn't have, if that makes any sense. Did I get enough negatives in there?
If you put enough negatives in, you can turn it into a positive. So anyway, I've got to say that I am very optimistic about what's going to happen in the near future. We certainly have some real challenges, but the recognition that nuclear power is an important and integral part of the solution to some of our challenges is encouraging to me. And anyway, I think that the more we talk and the more that we let people recognize that we have avoided nuclear for a while, maybe for some good reasons, but those reasons have been overcome by events.
Yeah, my view is more kids stay in school. Go nuclear, do something good for the country. We're going to need a lot of nuclear employees.
And you don't have to be a nuclear engineer to be a contributor to the nuclear industry.
Yeah, I mean to imply that you did, but it stay in school because you can work nuclear even without the nuclear degree.
Yep. What you need to do is get a good facility for math and understanding of science, be able to count, be able to take direction.
Reading and writing doesn't hurt either.
Oh, yeah. You have to certainly be able to
read. Patient skills really come in handy.
Yeah. If you are the kind of person that gets a new thing that has to be assembled and you throw away the instructions, you probably don't want to be a nuke.
Yeah.
If you're the one who pulls out the instructions and reads it carefully and inventories your parts before you even start the process of assembling, you may have the makings of a good nuke.
Oh, yeah, man. Follows instructions. Check that box off.
All right. Hey, Kelly, it's been great talking to you, and hope that your week goes well.
I expect it will. I got some cool stuff coming up this week. But it's always fun talking to you, Rod. Thank you for having me.
Good. Take care, and we'll talk to everyone again sometime soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Have a great one.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today,
Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.